Good afternoon. Lydia Burton with the Country Hour. A Katherine-based Vietnam vet has turned to repairing old military vehicles to keep the next generation engaged in Australia's military history. This Anzac Day, we take a look at his universal carrier, which has taken part in today's parade. That's coming up. Also today, a former NT chief minister says fracking is needed if the Territory's serious about development.
It's just really hard to see how the Territory gets ahead in terms of developing the infrastructure in our remote regions, the roads, the bridges, the telecommunications infrastructure, without having more taxpayers here in the Territory and more industry that is paying tax here in the Territory.
That's coming up after National Rural News.
G'day, I'm Brett Worthington. Farmers in Australia's northwest can barely wipe the smiles off their faces, and we will find out why very shortly. But let's begin in Victoria, where Anzac Day is traditionally the start to the winter grain sowing season in the west. But in what might ultimately prove to be a good thing, many can't this year because there's just too much rain. More rain fell overnight, which comes after storms dropped up to 60 millimetres in some areas last week. For conifer farmer Sam Eastwood, it's the best he's ever seen.
My generation of farmers, we haven't seen a break like this in our farming careers. Talk to our fathers and that. They haven't seen something like this for 20 years at least. So everyone's pretty happy to be able to kick the season off with such confidence.
Speaking of grains, an international team of scientists has this week published the most comprehensive analysis of the wheat genome. The detailed genetic map will help researchers breed traits like disease resistance. The study's co-author, Professor Harvey Miller from the University of WA, says the data will help also enhance food security.
We'll actually try and double crop yields before 2050 if we're going to feed people. So this is a big drive, I guess, in plant science now to say, well, what are the fundamental things we need to know if we're going to do that by 2050? And one of them is to have a really, really good map of the genomes of all of these major crops. And wheat, obviously, is right up there. It's one of the big ones.
Heading further north in WA, where thousands of cattle are on the move in the Kimberley region, as stations launch into their mustering programs after a big wet season. The Broome Port had its first live cattle ship of the year depart last night, and another six ships are due during the next 4 weeks. Ben Mills from Mandurah Station says farmers are working flat out as they try to take advantage of what looks like a great year.
Yeah, the last couple of years have been pretty dry too, so to have good prices, good options and plenty of weight on the cattle, it's a great start to it anyway.
Heading east in a Hunter Valley farmer's 30-year fight to protect prime agricultural land from open-cut mining has been honoured with a global award. Wendy Bowman is the first Australian to be presented with the Goldman Environmental Prize in almost 15 years. In 2014, she won an unprecedented case in the New South Wales Land and Environment Court against a proposed coal mine, which would have consumed her property. She tells the ABC Now it's been quite the uphill battle.
I seem to have been fighting against mining here for so long. I started about 1990-91 when I started Mine Watch, and that was because open-cut mines in the mid-80s just suddenly developed everywhere. There'd always been mining here in the valley, but it'd been underground.
Heading globally now, and share markets across the world have surged after the first round of the French presidential election. Pro-growth, pro-Europe candidate Emmanuel Macron is now most likely to win the runoff vote, quelling concerns that a win for Marine Le Pen would possibly see another exit from the EU. America's main indices are all up more than 1%. In Paris, the CAC 40 jumped more than 4%. London's FTSE and Germany's DAX also rose. Gold prices, though, have been flat in the last day.
Mrs. Murray, aye. Ms. Harris, no. Ms. Hassan, aye.
Well, it's been more than 3 months since he took office, but US President Donald Trump can now officially welcome his agriculture secretary to his cabinet. The US Senate this morning voted 87-11 to approve former Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue for the role. High-profile Democrats who voted against him are expected to run for the presidency in 2020. Now, this vote comes amid the president's tough talk on trade, which has Mexico threatening to buy its grain elsewhere. That has Kurt Hora, a farmer and head of the Iowa Corn Growers Association, worried. He told Harvest Public Media that trade is essential for their survival.
We want to make sure that we don't lose those markets because it takes a lot more to get a market back than it does to maintain and to build one.
Now, to finish with, it's on plenty of tables across Australia this lunchtime, but few would know just how close English mustard came to calamity. In 2007, England had one of its worst harvests on record, and the crop was at risk of no longer being grown. The following year, half the country's mustard growers stopped growing it. The few that remained formed a co-op, and almost 10 years on, the industry is growing and thriving. Farmer Judith Jacobs told the BBC, if nothing else, she's got a sense of pride at knowing that they managed to save their industry.
It's nice to sort of work as part of a team to keep this established crop going, basically.
Don't want to keep English mustard English.
Yes, to keep English mustard English and be an English mustard grower. So yes, and it is very nice to be able to hold your little pot of mustard and say, do you know what? We've perhaps produced something that's in that pot.
Something to keep in mind next time you're having a sandwich. And for today, that is the Rural News.
Thanks, Britt. And thankfully, we don't even have to imagine a world without English mustard. Luckily for us, 11 past 12 here on the Country Hour.
You're listening to the Country Hour with Lydia Burton on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
Today, everyone will be remembering someone. For me, my great-great-grandfather, William Clark, served in World War I and was decorated for bravery. The interesting thing here is he went on to re-enlist in World War II alongside his four sons, including my great-grandfather. This Anzac Day, I'm thinking of those men. And I'm sure you're thinking of someone as well. Here on The Country Hour today, we stick with that theme and look back at the role of farming families during both world wars, and also that connection that continues still to this day between veterans and life on the land. Also today on The Country Hour, farmers in the Ord Valley will be planting a crop this year that hasn't been grown commercially in the region for more than two decades. Can you guess which crop it is making a comeback? Find out if you're right before 1 o'clock here on the Country Hour. First today, as Territorians gather today in so many places, large and small, to commemorate Anzac Day, they pay tribute to those who gave their service and, in so many cases, their lives. In Katherine, commemorations are well underway. Dan Fitzgerald is at the Katherine RSL. Dan, what's the atmosphere like?
Yeah, g'day there, Lydia. The atmosphere, I'm out the back garden of the RSL here at the moment and pretty jovial. There's lots of people gathered around and the two-up competition has just started. With me here is Pat Carmody. For those who don't know, fill us in on two-up, Pat.
Well, it's an historical sort of an event. Of course, we staged it out every Anzac Day. It was a form of recreation and, I guess, money laundering in the old days when the boys were on the front. So we're just commemorating that. People like to exchange money, so that's what I'm here to be. I'm a conduit for exchanging of money between heads and tails.
All right, well, we're going to make a toss now. I've got $5 here for tails.
How about it for five? Get set on the side.
Give me a tail.
Give me that.
All right, Pat's got the three pennies lined
three pennies,
up on the board.
Three tails up. That's sudden death. You get a result every time. So you're going to have a spin, come into the centre of the ring, up over your head, long fella.
All right. I've got the board here. It's my first ever toss.
Up you go. No result.
No result. One of the pennies rolled off the tarp, so that's it. No result there.
No result. Get another go.
The second go here.
Same thing again. Come in, spinner.
I lost.
More practice. And it costs money.
There we are. Lost my first go at tails. Two up.
There you go, Dan. I'm glad it was only $5 on the line. Run me through what's happened in Katherine this morning.
This morning started off, Lydia, with the traditional dawn service down at the centre path just off the Katherine River. And then there was a parade this morning with a whole bunch of the Raffies from the nearby Tyndall base and returned servicemen. There are also some school kids and the pony kids, the pony club that paraded down the main street of Katherine. And then at 9:45, two fighter jets from Tyndall flew straight over the town. I whipped out my camera to take a photo of them, but they were just gone before I had any chance to do that. But one of those in the parade this morning was Vietnam veteran Jim King. He's pretty well known in the cattle industry for his days running a trucking business where he went to stations and communities mostly throughout the Victoria River District. But he's retired now and he spends most of his time looking at restoring old military vehicles, and he also has got a few hundred mango trees to keep him occupied. Jim today offered up his universal carrier, which is an open-top like tank-like machine for today's Anzac Day parade. And as he was getting ready for the parade a few days ago, he told me about the vehicle.
Originally, it's designed by the British. It was originally a universal carrier. It weighs about four tonne fully operational. That means to say it's loaded with fuel, oil, ammunition and guns. It's got a crew of four. The front-mounted gun is a Vickers machine gun. It's a water-cooled machine gun. It then had a Bren gun or a Lewis gun mounted over on the top of the engine, and there were three other mounts situated around the carrier that the operator could move the weapon from one mount to the next. Carrier, this one here, is serial number 3973. It never left Australia. It was virtually a training thing, and it was a reconnaissance communications. In other words, it was all full of radios, but it still had a crew of four men.
It never left Australia, but there are a few bullet dents in it here. What are they?
Well, the bullet holes, well, they're not holes, actually. It's their, when the armour was made in the factory, it was sent out, and their quality control was they fired a round at each piece of armour plating before it was put on the carrier. Now, if the round, a small arm round, went through the armour plating and shrouded the back, it was rejected and sent back to the manufacturer. If it only dimpled it, it was accepted and then it went into the carrier. Nearly every piece of armour on the carrier has a bullet hole, or not a hole, but a bullet dimple in it, except the front armour, which is approximately half to three-quarter of an inch thick.
It must be a little expensive hobby you've got yourself here. Is that why you've got a few hundred mango trees to help you along?
Yeah, well, if you were expecting to make a fortune out of the mangoes, you needn't do it. But my wife and I, and we just have a bit of a joke that at the end of the year, if we meet the cost of the power bill and the little bit of fertiliser and pruning of it, and we've got enough for a carton of beer or a bottle of wine over, we're laughing. But yes, it does. It helps to, if I've got to do anything to the old vehicles, but most of my old vehicles now are all up to scratch, and so I really haven't got much to spend on them, only time, and I've got a fair bit of that on my hand at present.
And what are you doing this morning to get it ready for the Anzac Day parade on Tuesday?
Well, it's been on display at the front of the block here now, under a shed. And what I do is, if the RSL comes to us and asks, yes, you can bring the carrier in, we will have the carrier, I just give it a check over, make sure everything's right. But I do start them at once a month just to keep the oils up. And but what they would do this morning is bring it down here. We'll just check the diff oils, engine oils, gearbox oils, fuel filters if we have to, but they're not there. They don't have to be changed because they haven't changed in the last week and a half. We've been having trouble with Opel. I put Opel fuel in it, which is a no-no. But apart from that, it's just maybe a little bit of a wash and a polish and go from there.
All right, well, let's start it up and see how it goes. Sounds like it still runs all right, Jim.
Yes, it goes good. Its top speed would be around about 40 mile an hour or 60 kilometres an hour. Because you're sitting in the front down low, and if you're going down a fence line, it makes the fence line look like a picket fence because you're so low on the ground. But in actual fact, you're only travelling around about 40 miles an hour, but I guess that's fast if you hit something.
What's the reaction you get when you drive this down the main street of Katherine in the Anzac Day parade?
Well, a lot of the younger generations haven't seen these, and second year ago that Al and I were there, and we had a lot of people coming up and asking questions about it. And the big thing about it that I liked was the kids, the younger generation. They're coming up and asking what it was, what it used to do, and, you know, it just caused a bit of interest in there, and it's a bit of history, and as far as I'm concerned, history, military history and Australian history should be taught as a compulsory subject in all schools throughout Australia.
What does Anzac Day mean for yourself, Jim?
Anzac Day is where all colours, race and creed should commemorate because of the sacrifice that our soldiers went through for this country. Right from the Boer War, First, Second, Korean War, Vietnam, current things, and any other conflicts that Australian troops have been involved in, and those that have lost their lives and come back with either wounds or other problems.
Thanks a lot for sparing some time for the Country Hour, Jim.
You're welcome.
Jim King, the owner of a collection of military vehicles in Katherine, and he's also a Vietnam veteran, speaking there with the ABC's Dan Fitzgerald, who's at the Katherine RSL, where Two Up is underway, as we just heard. Now, sticking with Anzac Day theme, we look back at the role of farming families, played not only on the battlefield, but also the role of those left behind. Historian Reg Watson recalls the significance of farming families' contribution, especially in the First World War.
Well, it's significant, of course, not only on the war effort. It was the backup to the war effort, giving the war effort support through the food production, which was necessary, which was deliberately increased to help the troops in the field, but also for export, even to the British force. The farming community, even though it had to produce more potatoes, more carrots, more peas, more apples, more fish, whatever, because of the war effort, manpower was in a shortage, simply because many of those country boys went and enlisted. Now, in those days, of course, the farms were family farms. And if you had an orchard, of course, it was necessary to gain support from your sons to keep that farm going. In those days, the wife was in the house and the daughters were helping with the mother if she wasn't already married. But when the boy left the home, sometimes two boys, sometimes three boys, it left a shortage, even though it was deemed to be an essential service.
When you drive through any of our smaller communities, one thing that stands out is that in some of the tiniest of them, there's a war memorial, and there's the Roll of Honour that lists those who went to war. And for the size of the community, the size of the contribution, as you say, possibly one in three of those who volunteered to go, it's quite massive.
It is quite massive, and that's an interesting point when you go through these little villages. You do see these remarkable little memorials, and it does indicate the impact that the war, or those that went to the war and lost their lives, had on the local community. Because these communities are very much different to what it is today. These communities were very dependent on their farming and the manpower to help those farms. Everyone would have known those people. Everyone would have known those families. And it would have been a substantial... And, of course, we're talking about those that died, but we're not talking about those who were wounded. For instance, I would say the ratio of those who died to those who wounded, it was twice as many who came back wounded. Now, many of those wounds were very graphic, but of course, once those men returned home, without being critical, they were probably a liability on the family. And you can imagine a person or young a man who had an orchard, you know, was hoping to and couldn't afford to employ anyone. When his son came home He had to be looked after. He wasn't helping on the farm, and poor old mum and dad had to perhaps look after that casualty for the rest of their life. And, of course, we mustn't forget that all men who returned home, all 100%, were affected psychologically. So you can understand, or we can appreciate, the great impact that this had on the local community, not only in helping on the farm, but socially as well. That's where the country feeling came in, I suppose, because when they came back, all these little communities held a social evening for them at the community hall. And you often see the news report, certain amount of money was raised, you know, £50 was raised for troopers such and such who came back. So they rallied behind as well the returning troops, and they're all looked upon as great heroes. So the impact on the country, the effort of the country was quite substantial, should be appreciated, not only in their manpower, which they gave to the war, but how they kept support going to the troops with the produce that they actually produced.
Historian Reg Watson talking to Nick Bosley-Pask about the role of farmers and farm workers in times of war. And of course, that connection between soldiers and farming continued when they returned too, with soldier settlement programs after the First and Second World Wars seeing many returned soldiers become established as farmers right across Australia. Working the land was a good fit for many former soldiers. But could it be the answer for today's returned servicemen and women? Well, AgriLabor Australia says its initiative to connect ex-defence personnel with careers in agriculture is succeeding in providing a clear pathway out of the armed forces. Managing Director Casey Brown says the AgriVeterans program is also helping to plug staffing gaps in agricultural industries.
From all the feedback we're hearing from ex-defence men and women, it's that, yeah, it is a struggle, because I guess when you're in the defence, virtually everything is done for you. It's taken care of, and it's like a family outside of your own. So it, when you have that, I guess, take that step to leave the defence, it can be very daunting and confronting. And I guess another fact that we hear a lot is people, men and women, don't know, I guess, you know, where their skills will align in civilian life and what that career may look like. So it is very daunting, and I guess we just try and, I guess, just bring awareness and bring some comfort and support that, you know, there is a place for all that want to come and have a level of interest or discussion around agriculture.
As you mentioned, it certainly does address a skills shortage in agriculture generally. But how have you found that people from Defence Force have been suitable to agricultural careers? Have those skills really gelled well with the opportunities?
To date, yes, they really have. And I think there's an uncanny connection with the skills that are learnt and the disciplines that are learnt within the Defence to the ag sector. And I think a lot, regardless of what your specific role was within the defence, I think the attitudes, the disciplines, and I guess what you are ingrained in you within the defence is very transferable within the ag sector. And it's quite broad. We've placed people within, you know, farmhand roles to farm manager roles to technician roles through into orchard technician roles. So to production mechanic role. So it's been very broad, the positions that we've filled ex-defence men and women into. So I guess that just highlights that the industry, that being the agricultural industry, is very open and willing to accepting new people into the industry, regardless of your direct specific skills. It's I guess a big focus on attitude, and I think that's what the people in the defence have learnt from the day they commenced.
And what sort of feedback are they giving you about how they're enjoying careers in ag?
Well, to date, I can only speak, and it's been extremely positive. You know, there's one really great story that we have of a young guy and his wife that moved out to Dirranbandi, and they took on a role out there as a sort of farm hand, and his wife integrated into the local community, and they've really accepted her, and she's doing part-time work at the school, and it's really changed their life. They didn't know what to do or where to go, and and they only heard about their program through a friend and contacted us, and they could not be happier. So we're getting more and more stories like that, and I guess we're also getting feedback from ex-defence people that are not quite ready for the permanent role yet, but they're looking for something just a bit more of a seasonal type role or a harvest type role. So we have plenty of those roles that are available just to give them a taste of agriculture.
Managing Director of AgriLabor Australia, Casey Brown, speaking with Jody Gunders about the Agri Veterans Program, getting ex-servicemen and women involved in agriculture, whether it's a permanent role, as he said, or whether it's just part-time to get a bit of a taster. We head to the Ord now, where farmers in the Kimberley's Ord Irrigation Scheme will grow mung beans commercially this year for the first time in more than two decades. It's a crop that farmers in the Douglas Daly region trialled last year. In the Ord, though, it's been spurred on by some promising results in a trial by the local Department of Ag. And now growers are set to plant up to 500 hectares. Matt Brand spoke to David Cross, who's the chief executive of the local farmers co-op, and got him to explain the plan for the Ord Valley mung beans.
So we've been looking at mung beans for a few years now. Last year there was a commercial trial conducted at DAFWA, and that was really interesting to get an understanding of how the crop performs in our region, what the agronomics are, and also what the yield potential is. We were encouraged with the results of that larger type commercial trial, and that's really given growers some confidence to go forward and plant some reasonable commercial hectares this year. The other thing that's led us down this path is the market for mung beans at the moment is particularly strong as well, so that's been another driver.
So really, roughly, what sort of hectares are you expecting?
We could have up to 500 hectares of mung beans in the valley this year. That's subject to the cropping mix being finalised. At the moment, we're obviously a little bit wetter than we'd like to be, and we've had a somewhat later start, so we're still juggling the mix at the moment, and that's one of the strengths, the advantages of the Ord, is to be able to be nimble and flexible and change with the season. So, but at this stage, we could see up to 500 hectares commercially, which is really interesting.
Apart from the trial, it's a crop that hasn't been seen in the Ord for a long time. Does that bring challenges?
It does. There is an element of risk attached to something that doesn't have a long cropping history. There's been some really impressive genetic varietal advances in the mung bean space, which again has given us a bit more confidence to go forward with it. And the attraction around mung beans is that it's amongst all of the grain crops, it's actually quite short in its growing period. So it does give us the opportunity to look at double cropping inside one dry season. So that's particularly exciting and of interest to us from a longer term perspective as a possible rotation option with a cotton industry, should we get that cotton industry established.
Double cropping, the sort of the holy grail for the Ord, isn't it?
That's right. That's certainly something we've been yearning for, and it perhaps gives the potential to double crop inside of the calendar year and avoid some of the challenges and risks associated with the wet season, particularly when you look at the wet season that we've just gone through.
In terms of harvesting this crop, does it just require the same gear that you'd use on your chickpeas and blotty beans and like?
That's one of the beauties of it, is we can use the existing harvest plant and equipment that we already have in the valley from a storage handling point of view. We can also use existing plant and equipment, so it slots into the mix, into the rotation quite well from that perspective.
And what are the plans on where to send it?
We've been speaking with some processors and marketers in the east, so they've been particularly helpful in helping us build the case, I suppose, for some mung bean production here in the Ord. So at the moment, that's where we're targeting to market the end product.
David Cross from the Ord River District Cooperative talking about the Ord's plans to grow mung beans after more than two decades since the crop was there. And of course, it was all spurred on by the Department of Ag having a very successful crop there last year.
G'day, my name is Rex Collins. I work at Sturt Plain. You know, I like the salt stations, I like work around here. I love it. Good work, everything. You're listening to Country Hour.
Ahead on the Country Hour, what are Gina Reinhart's plans for land in the Territory?
Well, we have a position of wanting to be Australia's biggest and best cattle company. And our purchases in the Northern Territory are not in any way, shape or form surrounded or involved in any onshore gas or mining potential developments. But in regards to whether the question about whether or not gas development and cattle properties can work together, I think absolutely they can.
Today, some of agriculture's heavyweights here in the Territory weigh in on the fracking debate. That's to come on the Country Hour. Now, though, let's get the latest in weather, and it's a good afternoon to Hatem Abraham. Hatem, what can we expect for the rest of this Anzac Day?
So we're expecting that mostly sunny across the top end with some shower and storms in the northeast of the top end, including some part of the northern top end east of Meningerida. So this is according to some kind of activities around the tropical low, just will north in the Arfurasi. And yeah, there's this low is the main focus of the weather around it. So as it's moved to the west, it will track the weather with it. So we're expecting that for tomorrow to be increasing in the shower storms in the northwest of the top end. Darwin may be not affect until later on Wednesday with some kind of isolated showers. The most impact of this tropical low will be over the northern part with heavy falls, and Tiwi is the most likely to get these heavy falls.
Okay, so that's what's to come and watching that tropical low for the top end. What about in the centre? A cool change was forecast. How cool can we expect it to get?
Yeah, so it's already it's moved over Alice Springs, so we're expecting that the maximum temperatures to drop from yesterday of 34 to today to 29, as well in Illara was yesterday 32 and today to become 27. As tomorrow, we're expecting that to push through to Tennant Creek and will drop the temperature by 30, but still now we are forecasting for Tennant Creek 35 as the surge not yet.
Okay, there. So a tale of two different weathers for the top end this week. Hatem Abraham, thanks for keeping us up to date.
Thank you and have a good day.
Hatem Abraham from the Bureau of Meteorology.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
Now, former NT Labor Chief Minister Paul Henderson says economic growth will continue to stall in Northern Australia without the development of the onshore gas industry. The debate over the hydraulic fracturing of shale rock deep beneath the Earth's surface to access gas took centre stage during the special panel session at the Northern Territory Cattlemen's Association conference in Darwin recently. Jason Strong from Australian Agricultural Company, Troy Setter from Consolidated Pastoral Company, Adam Giles from Hancock Prospecting and Paul Henderson from Bespoke Territory all took the opportunity to press their views on the divisive issue. Paul Henderson, who was Chief Minister from 2007 until 2012, says there needs to be more negotiation over land access and environmental regulation to allow the industry to develop.
One of the things that's doing my head in is that this debate is turning into a winners and losers debate. You know, I sat around the cabinet table for many years putting the budgets together, and the cattlemen's always used to provide a really well-argued, passionate case for more funding for roads and beef roads in the Northern Territory. And the reality is when the Territory only raises less than 20% of its own source revenue, we're just... we're just mendicant in terms of relying on the Commonwealth for funding. And when you see what happened the other day with the cut to the GST pool, it's just really hard to see how the Territory gets ahead in terms of developing the infrastructure in our remote regions, the roads, the bridges, the telecommunications infrastructure, without having more taxpayers here in the Territory and more industry that is paying tax here in the Territory. And so I was talking to Tracy Hayes about this a couple of weeks ago, and I asked where the protocol for access to pastoral leases was. And unfortunately, Tracy said that, you know, Cattlemen's worked really hard, it broke down. I'd really like to see an agreed best practice protocol for access. We're all Territorians. Call on Matt Doman and Apia to, in good faith, get back to the table with the Cattlemen's, because when we get to the point where we're all relying on lawyers and black letter law to determine rights, then I think the Territory's missing a great opportunity. So we have to have environmentally sustainable development. We absolutely must protect our water in the Territory. But if we're going to see the Territory reach its potential, we need that infrastructure. We're two seats in the House of Reps. We need to develop our own revenue sources here in the Territory. So let's get away from the winners and losers debate and let's come together as Territorians, protect our environment, protect our water and develop the Territory.
Is it fair to say you're not a fan of the Labor moratorium?
Well, I've said what I've had to say, so people can read into that. But, you know, it really is everybody coming together here and being sensible about it, you know. We all want better health services, we all want better education services, we all want better infrastructure. We're not going to have toll roads like the Sydney Harbour Tunnel in the Territory anytime soon, so where does the money come from? It comes from the taxpayer. Somebody's got to pay those taxes, and I'd like to see more industry here doing its fair share so that we can build the Territory and create the opportunity we all want to see for our kids.
Back to this end, Troy Setter, CPC recently provided a submission to the Hydraulic Fracturing Inquiry. Can pastoralism and gas coexist in the Territory?
Can it exist? I mean, I'm not anti-mining whatsoever, and my father worked for BHP for a long time, so certainly benefit from that. I don't think we know yet, to be honest. The water resources for our company, under particularly the Barclay, are really important to us, and we just don't know enough yet to be really confident. I hope that we can coexist. I hope we can share in the opportunities. I hope we can share in the spoils, both at a, you know, business level but also community level. I think that's really, really important. But for us is really being careful about those water resources, making sure that it's fair and equitable and safe. And if we get confidence in those things, then hopefully we can move forward together to really get some great benefits for the Northern Territory. So, you know, it's an old saying, but you can't unscramble an egg. So let's make sure that it's right before we kick off.
Jason Strong, AACo is the Territory's largest owner of pastoral land. Does the company have a position on fracking?
We didn't put a submission into the inquiry, and partly it's because of the size and position that we have and the potential in a controversial environment. We are very conscious of the potential we have to influence an argument either way. So we talked to the NTCA in quite a bit of detail about it, and we took some other advice from, you know, ex-politicians who have taken on consulting careers to help us putting that sort of communication together. But at a high level, the short answer to your question is, can these things coexist? As they have to. Now, we've got to work out a way to not be so limited in the way that we operate and manage our businesses. And this is tied to the investment piece, that what's the biggest challenge with making an investment in the Territory is that there's actually nothing else around it. So the plant that we've built, so call it a $100 million investment, it buys, and you can do the simple maths yourself, we process 115 or 20,000 cattle a year and they cost $800 or a bit more. It's $100 million worth of cattle. It's $15+ million worth of salaries and wages. It's another $5 or $10 million worth of contracting expenses, plus investment in energy and a whole range of different things. But there's no collective investment in roads or infrastructure or support to make sure that $100 million investment, $100+ million a year continual investment and turnover in the in the territory actually works. Now, you come back to the fracking or mining or other associated industry discussions, and you've got organisations that are prepared to invest in bores and water systems and road systems and telecommunications and all the things that make it nearly impossible to run our businesses. We've got to find a way to try and access those things and leverage those positions. So it's not just a case of there's this fantastic opportunity, let's get an investment or try and get some money in. It's like, how do we use the money that we have or the investments that we have to best leverage that into something even bigger and better? So it's not about, are you going to mine or not mine or frack or not frack or grow cows or not grow cows. It's how do these things work together so that we're much better off right across the board.
I'm just going to come back to you, Troy Setter, for a moment. Your submission to the inquiry included the right of veto, and we were speaking about foreign investment earlier. There's an argument over who really owns the gas underneath the station. Should the option of veto matter whether a pastoral lease is owned by a foreign entity or owned by a local family, for example?
I don't think it does. And whether you use foreign capital as equity or you use foreign capital as debt, you know, capital's capital in terms of, you know, in terms of that. I don't think there should be too much difference there. I think it's really important that we do the right thing by the Northern Territory and our water resources and make sure that we're looking after them and taking advantage of the opportunities that are available.
But you definitely support the right of veto?
At the moment, the right of veto, it's the right of choice. So I think that will bring people to the table to discuss and work out outcomes around access, outcomes around shared services, outcomes around who actually does what on that property, and then how do we actually deal with, you know, the gas and the resources that are underneath the property as well as above the property. So until we've got really clear rules in place and a clear understanding, I think we need to have that right in place so that we can bring people to the table to negotiate.
I'll bring you in at this point now, Adam Giles. Certain media outlets have been alleging Hancock Prospecting property acquisitions in the Territory have more to do with the company's interest in gas as opposed to the company's interest in beef. What is Hancock Prospecting's vision for northern agriculture?
Well, we have a position of wanting to be Australia's best cattle company, Australia's biggest and best cattle company. And our purchases in the Northern Territory are not in any way, shape or form surrounded or involved in any onshore gas or mining potential developments. But in regards to whether the question about whether or not gas development and cattle properties can work together, I think absolutely they can. And I think there should be an opportunity to be able to negotiate for access and so forth. And we want to make sure that the gas industry, just like any other industry that comes on a property, does their level best at being good citizens on that country. But there's been a few announcements and changes of recent times, particularly in South Australia, most recently by the South Australian Premier, when talking about royalties from gas or a part thereof flowing to property holders. And I think that is certainly something that needs to be discussed around Australia, not just in South Australia. I take on Paul's point about security of land tenure being a big issue in the Northern Territory, and I think that is probably one of the biggest issues from my experience in the past, and that is certainly one of the areas that causes headache for investors and scares off investors coming into the Northern Territory for the ability to be able to do business. But there is an opportunity to be able to work together. Hancock at the moment hasn't proceeded with any gas opportunities to date, and it's not doing anything anywhere where it has a lease, which is separate from where it has cattle, until we see what happens with the moratorium. But it can work together. It can work to the beneficiaries of all parties. And I think if we move to a position where part of the income stream from any potential gas comes to property owners, I think that'll certainly be a more welcome approach to working together than it has been in the past.
Adam Giles from Hancock Prospecting speaking during the panel session at the Northern Territory Cattlemen's Association Conference in Darwin. We also heard from Jason Strong, Troy Setter and Paul Henderson on their thoughts on fracking. Now, there's great potential to develop agriculture in the Territory. You just need the energy and passion. That's the sentiment of Fiona McBean from Old Cameron Downs near Batchelor. As a young woman in the pastoral industry, I asked her about her involvement so far and her hopes for the future.
Mainly my role is in the office, so obviously all the accounts, wages, and then our business here, we've got the breeding and fattening of trade animals, as well as last year opening an on-farm abattoir. So with regards to the abattoir, I do a lot of marketing, keep in touch with customers and suppliers, I do all the purchasing, and then 2 days a week I work off-farm.
How did you get involved in agriculture?
I basically grew up in the industry. Both my parents owned a property in just west of Katherine, and I've still got a lot of family in the industry, and I enjoy it and I stayed with it, yeah.
What do you think drives your passion for the industry?
I guess it's the love of the lifestyle, the love of the outdoors, of animals. Yeah, I really enjoy taking care of things, whether it's plants or animals, so just being outdoors and being able to do that.
If you look back, how do you think women's roles have changed in agriculture?
I guess I can look back to what my mum's role was when, so she was a midwife and then married my father and moved onto the land. And obviously not having the rural background, it was from a different beginnings to what I've had, but her role was always very much in the office, whereas I've grown up being given the opportunity to do anything from driving machines, riding horses, mustering cattle, and now I'm more than happy to be in the office. So it's just there are no boundaries. If you want to do it, then by all means give it a go.
Where's your favourite place to be on the property?
It would definitely have to be sunset, just driving around with my partner Pete, looking at what we're doing and talking about what we're going to do in the future.
How do you feel about your future and more broadly the future for the industry here in the Territory?
I think everything is what you make it. I think there's huge opportunity in the Territory, but it requires a massive amount of effort to make that a reality. I don't think anything can be taken for granted. But yeah, definitely, there's huge potential in the Territory, but it's just whether you've got the energy to turn that into a reality. There's always been potential up here, and there always will be.
What's your hope or your wish for the future of agriculture?
I really look forward to seeing a lot more private investment. I look forward to seeing a lot more families come to the land as opposed to large business. And I know that's just an economic decision, but I think the biggest steps forward in agriculture come from private families on smaller blocks doing amazingly original things and not so much just economies of scale.
Fiona McBean from Old Cameron Downs Station near Batchelor sharing her thoughts on the future of agriculture and what she'd like to see here in the Territory. That's all for the Country Hour today. Back to the same time tomorrow though at 1 o'clock, normal time. Join me then. I'm Lydia Burton. Have a great Anzac Day.